Welcome to the Criminal Justice Conversations podcast, a co-production of Berkeley Law School and the Berkeley School of Journalism. I'm your host, David Onick. Criminal Justice Conversations, recorded in the Berkeley School of Journalism studios, features in-depth interviews with a wide range of criminal justice leaders, law enforcement officials, policymakers, advocates, service providers, academics, and others. The program gets behind the soundbites that far too often dominate the public dialogue about criminal justice to have detailed, nuanced conversations about criminal justice policy. Today's guest is Greg Berman, director of the Center for Court Innovation. Berman has been with the center since its founding and became director in 2002. The center is a public-private partnership that seeks to reduce crime, aid victims, and improve public trust in justice. It has won numerous awards for innovation, including the Peter F. Drucker Award for Nonprofit Innovation and the Innovations in American Government Award from the Ford Foundation and Harvard University. Berman is the co-author of Good Courts, The Case for Problem-Solving Justice, and Trial and Error in Criminal Justice Reform, Learning from Failure. He's a graduate of Wesleyan University and, most importantly, of the Sidwell Friends School in Washington, D.C., where he was a couple years ahead of me in high school. He joins us from a New York studio this morning. Greg Berman, welcome to the program.
Thanks, David. Thanks for having me.
Greg, I want to start with the origins of the Center for Court Innovation. The center grew out of the Midtown Community Court, the first so-called community court in the country. Tell us about founding the Midtown Community Court.
So the Midtown Community Court began back in the early 1990s, and it's a little hard to put yourself mentally in that place now because New York has changed so much. But back then, we were talking about a New York that was known in many quarters as an ungovernable city, a place that I think was defined both in reality and in public perception by the idea of drugs and crime and disorder. It was a city that from 1970 to 1990 had lost something like half a million residents from its population as people fled to the suburbs and other safer environments. And there was no place that I think embodied the kind of battered image of New York more than Midtown Manhattan. Midtown Manhattan, the area in and around Times Square, which in some respects is kind of the beating heart of the city, was the misdemeanor capital of the world. There was more misdemeanors committed in the Midtown North and Midtown South police precincts, the two police precincts in and around Times Square, than any other precincts in the country at the time. The theaters were dark. Businesses were leaving New York. You know, again, all very different from the picture today. And against that backdrop, there came this idea that perhaps there was an opportunity to forge a new approach to justice in Midtown, and specifically to focus in on, like a laser beam, on the kinds of misdemeanor offenses that were clogging up the courts. And here I'm talking about crimes like prostitution, like low-level drug possession, shoplifting, and the like. And these cases, as we all know, are kind of minor in a legal sense, but they were ending up having a very major impact on the neighborhood. And I think our idea, those of us who worked in the early days of the Midtown Community Court, led by a visionary guy named John Feinblatt, I think we were motivated by an idea that we could bring the kind of wisdom of the broken windows theory, which had started to kind of pick up momentum in policing circles, and we could bring that logic into the courts. And so the Midtown Community Court was launched in 1993. It focuses exclusively on minor offending, so-called quality of life crime. And what we're trying to do there is forge a new approach that doesn't just kind of default to jail or fines. And instead, what we're trying to do is link criminal defendants to very visible community restitution projects, sweeping the streets, cleaning local parks, painting over graffiti, the kinds of very visible signs of disorder that I think undermine people's sense of safety in urban neighborhoods, and then also use the moment of arrest as a window of opportunity in a defendant's life and link him or her to the kinds of social services, whether it be job training or drug treatment or mental health counseling, that, knock wood, will help them get out of a life of repeated exposure to the criminal justice system. And so that's the basic history and idea behind the Midtown Community Court, to try to focus in on minor crimes and rethink how the court system handles them.
And, you know, the community court movement in those 20 years, I mean, when you started, would you ever dream that there are, you know, replications all over the country and all over the world now of what you were trying to do in Manhattan 20 years ago?
No, I think that I wish I could sit here and say that when I got started in this business in the early 1990s, that I had this grand vision of where it would go. But the truth of the matter is that I didn't. My agency has been the beneficiary of a lot of serendipity, to be honest. And we've been opportunistic. We've sought opportunities. And when we've seen opportunities, we've seized them. I think that we've never kind of set ourselves out to say that what we wanted to do was spread as many community courts as we possibly could. What we've tried to do is say that community courts are a potential solution to discrete criminal justice problems, and we've seen some replications in places like San Francisco, as you know, Seattle and Hartford and Dallas and other cities. But more than trying to replicate a model, I think that what we're really interested in is spreading a set of ideas that courts can kind of lift their heads up and see the forest for the trees, that we can get better access to information for judges so they can make more informed decisions, that we can create links between courts and social service providers so that we can drastically reduce the use of incarceration, that we can be more thoughtful about measuring the impacts of what courts do on the streets. These are kind of the ideas that underlie the Midtown Community Court. Mm-hmm. And as proud as I am of the replications of the Midtown Community Court, I'm probably more proud that those ideas, hard as it is to measure, seem to be gaining traction in the broader criminal justice world and in the broader court community.
And I think that's a really important distinction, because the ideas, every community is so unique that the word replication almost doesn't even make sense when you think about how localized criminal justice problems are and how localized the solutions need to be effective. So it seems that really the key thing for you guys to share are the ideas, and then each community will have to figure out how to implement those ideas in a way that works for them.
Yeah, I think that that's exactly right. I mean, we have the arrogance to put community right smack dab in the middle of the name of these projects. And so I think you really have to take seriously that idea of community. And as you say, every community is idiosyncratic. And so it doesn't make sense just to plop down the Midtown Community Court model around the world, around the country, or even in the next neighborhood over, because every neighborhood is different and every neighborhood is suffering from slightly different problems and has slightly different sense of itself and a slightly different resources and strengths that it brings to the table. And so we're very mindful of that. There's a quote that I like from a somewhat obscure British pop singer named Billy Bragg, who says that you can borrow ideas, but you can't borrow situations. And we try to live by that mantra. And so we're trying to spread ideas, but you can't replicate what was going on in Midtown Manhattan in the early 1990s. Thankfully, in some respects, that moment is gone forever.
Well, I'd like to hear the details of another one of the projects you're very well known for, the Red Hook Community Justice Center. How does that differ from the Midtown Community Court model?
So the Red Hook Community Justice Center was our second community court, and we operate that with the kind of active participation and support of the Brooklyn DA's office. Joe Hines is a kind of visionary leader when it comes to criminal justice. The New York State court system and Chief Judge Jonathan Lippman has been an enormous supporter. The city of New York has also been a big supporter. I could go on and list all the people that have been supporters. And we've helped kind of galvanize and conceive and implement the project with the support of all those public institutions. And what Red Hook is an effort to move some of the ideas that animated the Midtown Community Court to a very different neighborhood. So Midtown Manhattan, most of your listeners probably have been to Midtown Manhattan. You know, that's Times Square, that's Broadway, et cetera. Very, very few, up until recently, very, very few visitors to New York would ever go to Red Hook, Brooklyn. It's a very isolated neighborhood. It's a neighborhood with one of the largest public housing developments in the country, smack dab in the middle of it. It's a neighborhood that's cut off from the rest of Brooklyn by an elevated highway, so it's not well served by the subway system. And Red Hook is a neighborhood that often is not on the radar screen for New Yorkers, but emerged on the radar screen in a very powerful way in the mid-1990s when a beloved local school principal was shot in the middle in broad daylight while searching for a truant student. He got caught in a crossfire between two rival gang members. And in the immediate aftermath of that, Brooklyn District Attorney Joe Hines said that two things really had to happen. One was a very aggressive prosecution of the people that were responsible for the death, and he oversaw that. But, and I give a lot of credit to DA Hines, he said, you know what, we're not going to arrest or prosecute our way out of the problem here in Red Hook, and that what we need to do is make a much deeper investment in this neighborhood. And so that was really where the original idea for the Red Hook Community Justice Center came from. And so how Red Hook looks different from the Midtown Community Court, Midtown is exclusively focused on criminal cases. And in Red Hook, just because it's a much more of a residential neighborhood, we've decided to create a multi-jurisdictional courtroom that would handle the same kinds of minor offenses that are handled at the Midtown Community Court, but also handle juvenile delinquency matters from family court and some landlord-tenant disputes from housing court, from civil court. And that was the first time that that's ever happened, at least in the New York context. In addition, because Red Hook was a neighborhood that was suffering from a relative paucity of social services, we really tried to, in some respects, marry a courthouse with the kinds of proactive crime prevention and youth development programs that you might find in a community center. And so we've used Red Hook as a launching pad for a host of projects that are only tangentially related to the business of the courtroom. So we created a peer court, a youth court in Red Hook, where we trained local teenagers to handle actual cases involving their peers and use that as kind of a leadership development opportunity for area youth. We created an AmeriCorps program where we recruited 50 local residents to perform a year's worth of community service in their neighborhood. We did a number of kind of neighborhood beautification programs. We created, there's a central park in Red Hook called Coffee Park, and we created a drive to clean up and take back Coffee Park from drug dealers. It was one of those parks that was kind of where you were constantly stepping over crack vials and graffiti, and all the park benches were dilapidated. And, you know, fast forward to today, that park, it always had great bones, is now just a jewel. You know, you see families out there every day of the week using Coffee Park. That wasn't happening when we started back, how long ago? 2000 was when we opened the project.
Let me turn next to your recent book, Trial and Error in Criminal Justice Reform, Learning from Failure, which I thought was terrific. I've actually had it for a while, and this interview gave me the opportunity to make sure I sat down and read it. It really resonated with me with a lot of the experiences that I've had in the very difficult job of trying to implement criminal justice reform. And let me start by asking the question, why a book about failure?
I have a perverse sense of humor, and so I'm at my happiest when I'm being contrapuntal. And so I really felt like, and we write about this, and I should pause just for a second to credit my co-author, Aubrey Fox, who co-wrote the book with me. We wrote the book because we really did feel like there was just so many different books out there in the marketplace, both in the criminal justice space and in other public interest areas, where someone would kind of talk about their own success and market that as a pathway. If everyone could just do what I did, then the world would be a happier place. And don't get me wrong, there's a space for those books, and I'm a big consumer of them. And there's some of my favorite books probably fit into that description. But I guess in some ways, I felt like the book was penance in a way, because, you know, I run a not-for-profit organization, and when you run a not-for-profit organization, you're in some respects a professional supplicant. And a lot of what I do, and this is not to complain, but a lot of what I do is try to raise money and try to generate heat and interest in our ideas and in our projects. And that involves a certain amount of hyping. And my natural instinct is not to hype. And my natural instinct is to try to speak truth to power and speak honestly about what we're doing. And I guess I just felt like, and again, I don't think this is a unique diagnosis to criminal justice. I think you could probably say this about any field of endeavor. I felt like there was a lot of hype out there in the marketplace where people would say, you know what, I can solve your crime problem by doing X, Y, or Z. And having been in this world and done this work for a while, I guess I felt like the truth was just so much more complicated than that, and that as great and as proud as I am of projects like the Midtown Community Court and the Red Hook Community Justice Center, and I can quote you chapter and verse about, you know, what the independent evaluators say and this good impact and this wonderful result, you know, these projects fail as much as they succeed. It's very, very hard work to try to turn around the life of an addicted offender who's been involved in the criminal justice system for 20 years. They don't turn on a dime. And so in some small way, penance is probably too strong a word, but I felt like it was the book was an effort on my part to kind of introduce kind of some levity and try to introduce some honesty into the conversation about criminal justice reform, because I felt like if we continue to overpromise, if we continue to overhype what we're doing, then inevitably we'll fall short of that. And, you know, my father's a businessman, and he always used to teach me that the key to business is to under-promise and over-deliver. But I felt like, you know, again and again in the criminal justice system, we were doing kind of the opposite of that. And so we wrote the book focusing on failure as, you know, and we're modest about what this book is going to achieve, but in some small way to try to introduce a note of kind of honesty into the public conversation about criminal justice reform.
And in the book, you really delve into, you know, what causes these failures, and you divide it into four types of failures: a failure of concept, failure of implementation, failure of marketing and politics, and failure of self-reflection. And you use the story of one program, St. Louis's Consent to Search program, to give examples of each type of failure. Can you walk us through the four types of failure using the St. Louis example?
Yeah, I'll try to. You're stretching my memory of the book. It's been a little while since I wrote it. So the Consent to Search project is a fascinating program, which, and credit where credit is due, two wonderful researchers, Richard Rosenfeld and Scott Decker, have written extensively about consent to search, and we relied heavily on their work in writing that chapter. But consent to search was essentially an effort that was undertaken by the St. Louis Police Department back in the dark days of the 1990s in an effort to try to get guns off the streets. And they would go into, they would ask for permission to go into the homes of juveniles whom they suspected of possessing guns. And the explicit deal of the program, at least when it was first started, was that the police would agree not to make an arrest based on what they found in the house. So if they found a gun, if they found drugs, what have you, they were not going to make an arrest, that they were solely focused on getting rid of the guns. And this was an idea that kind of bubbled up from the ground level, that was created by, a handful of creative entrepreneurial police officers in St. Louis. And over its first period, you know, in its first year, remarkably successful in not only getting people to assent to have their houses searched, but remarkably successful, took hundreds and hundreds of guns off the streets. And very exciting initiative. It was featured in national policing conferences. President Clinton, who was president at the time, even mentioned it in some remarks that he gave. It was one of these kind of exciting innovations. And the project ended up collapsing and thus earning its inclusion in our book about failure And it collapsed slowly. It was almost a slow motion collapse. It collapsed in several different stages. And over the course of its collapse, it came to embody, I think, a number of our ideas about why projects fail. It was adapted at a certain point to get rid of the promise not to make an arrest. And lo and behold, no one consented to have their house searched in that context. And so that, to us, was an example of just, that's a bad idea, right? That was never going to work. It embodied a failure of implementation. At other stages, they made a decision to, when they were going into the homes, the police officers were finding, not surprisingly, a lot of dysfunction, a lot of families in crisis with deep social service needs. And so they wanted to not just seize the guns, but figure out a way to link these families in need to needed interventions. And so they partnered with a group of clergy to do that. And I don't want to get caught in the weeds, but they just kind of chose a bad partner. And so that was, in our view, an example of failure of implementation. The project collapsed at one point because it was very identified with the chief of police in St. Louis, and the chief of police in St. Louis left to run for mayor, and there became a new chief of police. And so anything associated with the old chief was just kind of tossed out by the new chief. And we see that over and over again in criminal justice. And again, I don't think this is a unique phenomenon to criminal justice. And so we've labeled that kind of a failure of politics. They didn't get anything wrong conceptually or in terms of implementation. They just didn't manage the politics right in that case. And then finally, the kind of failure of self-reflection. This was a project that was conceived of and implemented by beat cops, essentially. And it was not a project that had any kind of architecture or infrastructure behind it. They didn't do a good job of keeping records. They didn't do a good job of kind of pausing for breath at various points along the way to analyze how the playing field had changed. And for us, that embodied a failure of self-reflection, that they were not able to kind of change course in midstream the way you need to quite often when you're running projects. And so in those various ways, we kind of use the example of consent to search as a way to talk about the four different types of failure.
And let me hone in on one of them a little more, the failure of marketing and politics, because I think there's a lot to say about that. But I think sometimes when people come in and want to start a program, they say, we don't really want to get involved in all the details of the politics in a local situation. We're above that. We're trying to bring this model. And I think there's a failure to understand that if you don't get involved, that's the only way. You need to figure out how to get things done and get buy-in on the local level. And if you won't get your hands dirty and roll up your sleeves and do that, there's just no way you're going to get local buy-in and be successful.
Yeah, I think that your analysis is exactly right. That the kind of, and it sounds like you've seen some of it too, the kind of white glove approach to reform, I find, I'm sure there's some exceptions that counter this narrative, but I find it almost always doesn't work. I do think that there is a tendency sometimes among people like me, people that work for the not-for-profit sector and who are outside of government, to view what happens inside of government with, disdain, and it's all political, and sometimes and we're going to somehow rise above that. But as you say, I just don't think that that's a recipe for actually getting things done in the real world. I think that you're right. I think to really make a difference, you do have to mix it up. You do have to get your hands dirty. You do have to understand the nitty-gritty of, this DA hates this police chief, or this mayor is trying to do X and city council wants to do Y, or what have you. Because at the end of the day, again, I said before that I'm a professional supplicant. I think those of us who are outside the criminal justice system that are trying to get the criminal justice system to reform are in fact in the position of professional supplicants, and that you do always need permission, money, space from those in power. And those in power are political actors at the end of the day. And so I think those of us who fancy ourselves reformers ignore that at our own peril.
And how about using the Midtown Court as an example? I mean, 20 years later, it's going as strong as ever. How were you able to, you know, you talk about how when a police chief leaves, when a judge leaves, I mean, the average department head in city government lasts about a year and a half, I think I saw in a recent study. So leadership change is going to be inevitable when you're talking about reform. How have you guys been able to keep this going consistently for two decades now?
Well, you know, not again, knock wood, because things can change.
Sure.
I think you really do highlight one of the key challenges, which is that leadership change is in fact inevitable, and you're always going to have to deal with that. And that I spoke before about how difficult it is to achieve change. And the kinds of changes that you in the past have advocated for and that my organization has tried to espouse, These are changes that don't happen overnight, and I would argue don't happen even within the kind of typical political life cycle of 2 years or 4 years. And so at the risk of self-congratulation, I would argue that one of the keys to the longevity of the Midtown Community Court, which, as you said, has gone through multiple judges, multiple mayors, multiple chief judges, has been the existence of an organization like the Center for Court Innovation that wasn't thinking of it as in 2 years or 4 year terms, but was really thinking of it as and committed to that model for the long haul, and so that we could take the long view where others might have been inclined to kind of view it in more short term perspectives, and that we were able to stay involved with that project and advocate for it behind the scenes when necessary and make mid-course adjustments to try to improve the program, and that in some ways has been kind of crucial to its ability to survive for 20 years.
The Center for Court Innovation does a lot of what is called action research, and this research falls far short of the gold standard of research, randomized controlled trials, but is far above the level of research that's done on most programs, which is frankly none. So can you talk about what action research is and the challenges in conducting action research?
Yeah, I do think that, you know, as you say, randomized trials are the gold standard, and there are organizations and advocates who are pushing very strongly for there to be more randomized trials in criminal justice, and I think that that's good and appropriate. I don't think that we should fetishize the randomized controlled trials. I think that there's lots of other different kinds of studies that are in fact valuable. I think there's lots of projects and lots of settings where a randomized trial isn't appropriate or feasible. And so we believe, and we're not the first people, and we're not the only people to believe in this idea of action research. We've certainly built on the model that places like the Vera Institute of Justice established and Herbsters established, you know, more than a generation ago. But what we believe in is embedding research in all of our operating projects. And so most of our major operating projects have a full-time researcher attached to them who is not an independent evaluator, works for us, but his or her job is to constantly be feeding us data about how the project is going so that we can understand, oh, is there a dip in compliance? Maybe we need to tweak this. Are we not getting the kind of caseload volume that we expected? Well, maybe we need to do X, Y, and Z to boost it. So again, it's about creating an architecture, the kind of architecture that, frankly, the consent to search program didn't enjoy, so that when things go wrong, because we live in the real world, things go wrong, we're able to respond to that. And the way we do it is by kind of creating this marriage between research and operations that we call action research.
I want to close by asking about some of the most promising new demonstration projects that the center is involved in. Can you share a few of those as we leave off?
Yeah, sure. You know, we have this my organization doesn't have a mission statement. I like to say our mission statement is our name. And because we have the arrogance to put innovation in our name, we have a clear institutional mandate to constantly be coming up with new ideas and testing new approaches to justice. I think that there are kind of three areas that we're working on now that feel new to me and that feel like they're potentially rich. The first is that we're attempting to create a new community court in a neighborhood of Brooklyn called Brownsville. And Brownsville right now is kind of ground zero for two things. One, it's ground zero for violence in New York City. It's a neighborhood that's been mostly untouched by the public safety gains that New York has made over the past 20 years. It's also been the focus of a lot of attention, including a major New York Times story, because it's a place where the police department has done, a lot of stop and frisk activity. And so there's not unanimous, don't get me wrong, because the community never speaks with one voice, but there is a segment of that community that feels very aggrieved and disenchanted with justice. And those two things, a very concrete and real public safety problem and a sense of disconnection between citizens and government, those are ripe areas for a community court to make an intervention. And so we've started to perform a community needs assessment and lay the groundwork for a community court in Brownsville that I'm optimistic we'll get off the ground in the next year or so. Related to that, we've been investing more and more of our energy as an institution in juvenile justice. Our roots, and we talked a little bit about our roots at the Midtown Community Court. The Midtown Community Court's an adult criminal court. More and more, we've been kind of interested in seeing whether we can apply some of the lessons that we've learned from working with adults to juveniles. And this kind of lines up neatly with one of the priorities of New York State Chief Judge Jonathan Lippmann, who's been very interested. New York is one of the outliers. The age of criminal responsibility in New York is 16 rather than 18, the way it is in many places, many states. And Chief Judge Lippmann, one of his priorities for the new year is trying to forge a new court-based response to 16 and 17-year-olds in criminal court that kind of combines some of the due process protections that are desirable from criminal court with kind of the rehabilitation orientation of family court. And so we're going to kind of help Judge Lippmann and work on that. That's an area that we're very interested in. And then lastly, I would point to the issue of procedural justice as a potential growth area for us that we're very interested in. One of the enduring lessons of our projects, when they are successful, one of the reasons we find that they do make an impact and that they do move the needle in terms of improving compliance with court orders or improving compliance with drug treatment in terms of getting people out of a life of crime, is because we take great pains from the judge on down to communicate with people in an incredibly respectful way and to treat people as individuals rather than as widgets going through a factory. And so this idea, which was kind of espoused by Yale Law professor Tom Tyler and Judge Kevin Burke and others, that by focusing in on the process and improving the process by which people go through the criminal justice system, you can not only improve their faith in public institutions, but you can actually improve their compliance with the law. That idea, I think, is kind of at the heart of so much of what we do. And going forward, we're very interested in looking at opportunities to spread that idea broadly.
Well, it sounds like some very interesting things ahead. We look forward to seeing what happens. And Greg Berman, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Please tune in next week when we'll be joined by Stanford Law Professor Joan Petersilia. Thank you for listening to the Criminal Justice Conversations podcast. You can find this episode of the podcast and all prior episodes on our website at www.law.berkeley.edu/CJConversations, on iTunes, and on NPR affiliate KLW's Cross Currents site. You can also become a fan of Criminal Justice Conversations on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter at CJConversations. Our production assistant is Nicole Jones. I'm David Onick. Thanks for listening.